"I hear you speak," he retorted, "like the clapper bird of Punt, with tongue like a rattle, who hears and repeats what is not in its head. The marrow of the lands, and the good old ways, and the laxity of foreign ones, all that is Becknekon's. Those are his disagreeable and crafty words, and it upsets me to have you repeat them, for your coming gave me hope of familiar converse with yourself, not with him." "I only remind you, my friend," she answered, "of his views, which you know, in order to protect you from serious unpleasantness. I say not that Becknekon's thoughts are mine." "But they are," he retorted. "I hear his voice in yours. But you do not utter his thoughts as something foreign in which you have no share, but rather you have made them yours and are of one mind with him, the shiny-pated priest, against me, and that is what I cannot bear. Do I not know that he goes in and out in our house, visiting you each quarter of the moon, or even oftener, and always to my unspoken distress, for he is not my friend. I cannot bear him or his guile and bad manners. My nature and temperament demand a mild, refined, and tolerant sun-sense. Thus, in my heart, I am for Autumn Re, the tolerant god, but especially because I belong to Pharaoh, and am his courtier, for he permits the experimental thought of his wise men to dwell upon the benign and universal sun-sense of this glorious god. But you, my consort and sister before gods and men, where do you stand in these matters? Do you hold not with me, in other words, with Pharaoh and the tendencies of the court, but rather with Amun the inflexible, the brazen-browed? Do you lean to his party against me, and are of one house with the chief shiny-pate of the ungracious god, not realizing how offensive it is to infringe upon my dignity or show me disloyalty?" "You use comparisons, my lord," said she, in a voice thin and pinched with anger, "lacking in good taste, which is strange considering the reading you do. For it is without taste or in poor taste to say that I am of one house with the prophet, and therefore disloyal to you. That is a lame and distorted comparison. I must remind you that Pharaoh is Amun's son, according to the teaching of the fathers and the people's ancient belief, and therefore you would do no violence to your duty as courtier by paying heed to the sacred sun-sense of Amun, however ill-mannered you find him, and by bringing him the light sacrifice of your own and your guests' curiosity in respect of a paltry dance, however striking. So much with respect to yourself. As for me, I am utterly and entirely Amun's, in piety and devotion, for I am the bride of his temple and of his house of women. Hathor am I, and dance before him in the garment of the goddess. That is all my honor and my desire, and further have I none. This honorable rank is my life's sole content. And you would quarrel with me, because I keep faith with the Lord my God, an unearthly spouse, and make comparisons against me that cry to heaven with their falseness." And she lifted up a fold of her mantle, and bending over, shrouded her face with it. The captain of the guard was more than distressed. He shuddered. He even felt cold all over, for it seemed to him that intimate matters, always most tactfully passed over in silence, threatened to come to speech in the most shocking and destructive way. He leaned with his arms spread out along the back of his seat, still farther away from her, and sat numbly, looking down, indignant, guilty, and bewildered, to where she wept. "What is this?" he thought. "It is all quite wild and unheard of. It threatens danger to my peace of mind. I went too far. I brought my justified self-interest into the field, but she struck it down with her own. It is not only our talk, for my heart is pierced by her words, so that pity and pain are mingled with my dread of her tears. Yes, I love her. I know it by my dread of her tears, and would like to let her know it by what I say." He raised his arms and bent over her, yet not touching her, as he said, not without painful hesitation, "You see, dear flower, indeed, your own words make it clear that you did not speak solely to warn me of Becknekkens's churlish state of mind, but because you share it, because his ideas are yours, and your heart is of his party against me. You have said it plain and clear in my face. I am utterly and entirely Amund's. Those were your words. Was then my comparison so false? And can I help it that the taste of it is bitter to me, your husband?" She took the mantle from her face and looked at him. "Are you jealous of God, the Hidden One?" she asked. Her mouth was wry, scorn and weeping mingled in the jeweled eyes so close to his that he started and bent back again. "I must retreat," he thought. "I have gone too far, and must by some means or other withdraw, for my own peace and for the peace of the house, for both stand in sudden and horrible danger. How can it have happened that they are both so threatened, and that this woman's eyes are all at once so terrible? Everything seemed so safe and plain." And he recalled many a homecoming from a journey or from the court, when his first question to his steward was always, "Is all well with the household? Is the mistress happy?" For there abode in his inmost mind a secret misgiving about the peace of the house, its dignity and security, a dim consciousness that its footing was weak and imperiled. And now, by the look in Annie's angry eyes, by her tears, he knew that he had been right, and that his secret dread threatened to fulfill itself. "No," said he, "far from it. The idea that I could be jealous of Amun the god, that I repudiate. Well I know how to make distinction between what is due from you to the Hidden One and what to your spouse. And if, as I think, the expression was displeasing to you, which I used to characterize your familiar intercourse with Becknekkens, I am at all times ready and even seek occasion to give you pleasure, and will do so by withdrawing the comparison about being of one house. It shall be as though I had not said it, and that it be erased from the record of my words. Are you content?" Mut let her wet eyes dry of themselves, as though she were unconscious of the tears that stood in them. Her husband had expected gratitude for his complaisance, but she showed none. "That is but a small matter," she said, shaking her head. "She sees that I shrink in respect of my fear for the peace of my house," he thought, "and she will use her advantage, as is a woman's way. She is more a female than she is an individual, and my wife. I may not be surprised, though it is always a little painful to see the eternal feminine displaying its wiles in one's own wife. It would make one laugh ruefully. It has indeed an irritating effect upon me to perceive that a person thinks to deal according to his individual mind when all he really does is to repeat the general pattern. Mortifying indeed it is. But what use are such thoughts? I can only think, not say them. What I must say is this." And he went on, "Probably not of the smallest, indeed, but still the least of what I would say, for I did not think to end with it, but rather to increase your relief by saying that while we have been speaking, I have reconsidered my idea of inviting the Babylonian dancers. I have no wish to anger a highly placed man to whom you stand in close relations by seeming to offend what may seem to me his prejudices, but which I have, even so, no desire to attack. Our entertainment will be brilliant enough without the foreigners." "That, too, Petitpré, is most unimportant," she said. She called him by his name. He noted it with mounting apprehension. "What do you mean?" he asked. "Still unimportant. Most unimportant of what? And compared to what?" "To that which is desirable. To that which is needful," answered she with an intake of breath. "There should be changes. There must be changes here in this house, my husband, that it may not become a house of offending to the pious, but instead a place of good example. You are the master. Who does not bow before you? Who would not grant you the mild refinement of the tolerant sun-sense by which you order your life and which you practice in all your ways? I see well that one cannot at the same time be for the kingdom and for the stern old ways, for out of the second came the first, and life now in the richness of the kingdom must be otherwise than in the simplicity of the old times. You must not say that I have no understanding of life and its changes, but there must be measure in all things, a remnant of the ancient discipline, out of which sprang the kingdom and the riches of it, must be preserved and held in honor, that the lands become not shamefully corrupt and the scepter fall from their hands. Would you deny this truth, or would Pharaoh's wise men deny it, they who occupy themselves with the mobile sun-sense of Atum Re? Nobody, responded the fan-bearer, denies the truth. It might be dearer than even the scepter. You speak of destiny. We are children of our age, and it seems to me it is always better to live by the truth of the time wherein we are born than to try to guide ourselves by the immemorial past and the stern maxims of antiquity, and so doing to deny our own souls. Pharaoh has many mercenaries, Asiatic, Libyan, Nubian, even native. They will guard the realm so long as destiny permits. But we must live in sincerity. Sincerity, said she, is easy, and therefore it is not lofty. What would become of men if each would live only in the sincerity of his own desires, claiming for them the dignity of truth, and unwilling to be strict with himself to his own improvement? The thief, too, is sincere, and the drunkard in the gutter, and likewise the adulterer. But shall we, by reason of its sincerity, pass over their conduct? You wish to live in sincerity, my husband, as a child of your time, and not according to the ancient precepts. But that is barbaric antiquity, where each lives according to his lust. A more advanced age demands the limitation of the personal for the sake of higher considerations. Wherein would you have me alter myself? He said in some panic. In nothing, my husband. You are unchangeable, and far be it from me to shake the sacred, moveless calm of your being. Far, too, any reproach, because you make nothing your affair in the household or elsewhere in the world but to eat and drink. For if this were not a consequence of your nature, it would be of your rank. Your servants' hands do all for you, as they will do in your tomb. Your part is but to command, or not even this, for you command only one, him who is set over all to direct the house in your name, in the sense that it is the house of a great man of Egypt. Only this, this alone is your affair, a thing of the utmost ease, yet of the last importance, that you should not err nor point wrongly with your finger. Upon that all depends. For years, which I no longer count, said he, Montcalm has been my steward, a worthy soul who loves me as he should and is sensitive for all that could give me offence. Never, so far as I could tell, has he betrayed me in great matters, or hardly in small, and he has administered the household nobly and fittingly to my state. Has he the misfortune to incur your displeasure? She smiled contemptuously at his evasion. You know, she answered, as well as I and all of Waysay, that Montcalm is dying of his kidneys, and for some time has had as little charge of affairs as you yourself. Another rules in his place, whom they call his mouth, and the advancement of this youth in your household must be seen to be believed. But that is not all, for it is said that after Montcalm's expected death, this so-called mouth shall step into his place, and all that you have shall fall into his hands. You praise your steward for his loyalty to your interest. But in this matter, I seek in vain for evidence of it. You are thinking of Osarsif? She bowed her head. It is a strange way of putting it, she said, to say that I am thinking of him. might the Hidden One grant, there were no ground to think of him. Instead of which one is driven to do so by this blunder of your steward, and in a way most mortifying to our pride. This ailing man bought him you speak of as a boy from some travelling peddlers. Then, instead of treating him as befitted his base blood and origins, he advanced him, and let him take the upper hand in the house. He put all the household under him, my servants as well as yours, till you yourself, my lord, speak of him, a slave, with a readiness most painful to me, which rouses up my anger. For if you had stopped to think, and then said, Do you mean the Syrian, the Hebrew lad from the wretched Retenu? That would have been natural and fitting. But things have gone very far. Your own words betray it, for you spoke as though he were your cousin, naming him familiarly by name, and asking, Are you thinking of Osarsif? Thus, then, she too uttered the name, bringing it over herself with a secret ecstasy and blissful satisfaction. She spoke the mystic syllables, with their echo of death and divinity, syllables conveying to her fate's utmost sweetness in their sound, with a sob. But she pretended that it was a sob of outraged dignity, and once more she hid her face in her mantle. For the second time, Petipre was sincerely alarmed. "What is it? What is it, my love?" he said, stretching out his hands above her head. "More tears? Let me understand why. I spoke of the slave by his name, as he calls himself and is known to all. Is not a name the quickest way to indicate one's meaning? And I see that I was correct. You did have in mind that Canaanitish youth who serves me as cup-bearer and reader, to my great satisfaction, I deny it not. Should that not be a ground for you to think favorably of him? I had no part in his purchase. Montcalm, who has power to buy and to sell, took him years ago from some honest traders. But it came about that I had speech with him to try him when he was putting date blossoms to ride in my orchard, and found him exceedingly pleasing, gifted by the gods with graces of body and mind most unusually mingled. For his looks seem but the natural expression of the charm of his spirit, and in turn his mental parts are in invisible correspondence with the outward grace, so that you will, I hope, permit me to call him remarkable, for it is the due and proper word. His origins are not of the best. Indeed, one might, if one chose, call his birth virgin, but at least he who begot him was undoubtedly a prince of a sort, a prince of God, and king over his flocks. And the boy led a princely life, and was favored with the gifts of favor, where he grew up amongst his father's flocks. After that, indeed, affliction was his portion, and there were those who set snares for his feet, and he walked into them. But even the tale of his sufferings is remarkable. It has spirit and sense. It holds together, as one may say, and in it there rules that same combination which makes his inward and outward parts seem one and the same thing, for it has its own reality, but also seemingly a higher reference as well, and both so related that one is mirrored in the other, which only adds to the youth's mysterious charm. When he had not ill sustained the test I gave him, he was appointed my cup-bearer and reader, without my stir, out of love of me, of course, and I confess that in this capacity he has become indispensable. But again he has grown up, without any motion of mine, to have oversight of all the things of the household, and it is proved that the Hidden One grants success through him in all that he does. I cannot put it otherwise. And now that he has become indispensable to me and to the house, what would you have me do with him?